Hey everybody, this was the long promised and awaited talk I had with Shane Bowman about Twin Peaks, the classic series. This is me after I've seen, I think, the first two seasons with some minor exceptions that we'll talk about in a podcast. I don't think I'd seen Fire Walk With Me. I have seen that since, and we'll probably be getting back together. My goal is to have a couple other podcasters who have expressed an interest in talking about Twin Peaks with me to talk about Fire Walk With Me and then catch me up with the new season and then maybe do periodic check-ins after that. But we have to start somewhere. This is my experience in going through the classic series, Twin Peaks Season 1 and 2, which you can watch for free on Netflix, assuming you have a Netflix subscription, as always. So let's get right to it. Joining me now is Shane Bowman. You've heard Shane on a lot of Bald Move podcasts. Shane's one of the oldest members. Well, I don't want to say that. You've been with the Bald Move community from almost the very beginning. I think you're with us in the Blue Yonder days, but certainly at the beginning of our Breaking Bad coverage. He runs the Heisenberg Chronicles, the premiere repository for all things Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul fandom. You can hear him on Film Schlubs. You can find him on lurking at forums.baldmove.com as HyperGeneSB. Welcome to the podcast once again, Shane.
Thanks, Aaron.
We invited you on the podcast because I remember talking to you about Twin Peaks because I was, you know, what started all this is the Twin Peaks Commission. The community banded together and a bunch of people ordered us to commission or to do a podcast on Twin Peaks, which was a ballsy thing to do because Jim is a noted David Lynch hater. Now, I haven't seen a lot of his work. I mean, I've seen it more now through Bald Move, but like I never understood why like he hated him because like I had some affection for him because I was a big Frank Herbert fan. I love the Dune series, and even though it was a confusing mess, his movie I thought was very visionary and was a great visualization of like the greatest hits of the first novel. And the novel itself is kind of trippy, and I felt that his style lended itself towards that. And then, you know, I think there's a commission podcast someone had us watch. What was the? It's not Blue Velvet. It's the one about the
Lost Highway.
No, it's the one about the dream with
Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, Mulholland Drive.
Mulholland Drive.
And I remember thinking that was a really good movie. I really liked it. And then we watched the Twin Peaks show, and we watched the first two episodes. I ended up watching the first three episodes, and I immediately like, oh my god! Like I see. There's some dated things here. There's some things, like, very soapy things I don't understand. But I immediately saw the quality of the project and thinking, like, what in the hell must have people thought in the late 80s, early 90s when this kind of stuff, you know, like some maniac gave David Lynch a television show and told him to do something with it. And since then... just to let you know, because I don't know what I did is I went on because I'm really trying to catch up as much as possible so I can start the new series on Showtime. And so what I did is I watched the entire first season, which is only what 8 episodes, 10 episodes.
Depending on how you count it, it's 7 or 8.
Okay, and then I watched the first 12 episodes of season 2, right up to where David Duchovny shows up as Denise. Then I skipped to the final two episodes, which was a trip because they introduced Heather Graham showed up out of nowhere. This Wyndham Earl character showed up out of nowhere. And it's all this psychological battle for the soul of Dale Cooper in the Black Lodge that he eventually loses. And then the series ends there. Let's talk about your relationship with Twin Peaks, because in conversations with you, I get that you were like an old school David Lynch fan who was like primed, like was excited for the series and was part of like watch parties. Tell us about what it was like to be that person in 1990, getting your mind blown by this.
Well, you know, I've told this story a couple of times, I think, in the forums. My first experience with David Lynch was I went to see in Thanksgiving one year, my girlfriend, she worked at the local movie theater, and they had a double feature canned food drive. So you brought two cans of food and you got to watch two movies. And the movie was Pretty in Pink. Okay. So this was back in the era of high school movies, you know, Breakfast Club, right. The John Hughes movies. Right. And that's what I really came to see was Pretty in Pink. But it was a double feature. And I don't know what sick person did this, but it was a double feature with Blue Velvet.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And Blue Velvet is probably one of the biggest, you know, early mind fucks that David Lynch dropped on the world. You know, it had Dennis Hopper. It was the debut of Kyle MacLachlan, Laura Dern, and a lot of what became Lynch's stable of actors that he used over and over. But the double feature started with Blue Velvet, and I sat down and I could not believe what I was seeing. And I absolutely fell in love with the visuals. And the story was unlike anything I'd ever seen. I mean, I was 16. I was pretty straight laced, and it was revolutionary in the way I viewed film and its potential. And it kind of kicked off a lot of things in my life. Seeing Blue Velvet changed me in a number of ways. And I applied to film school at NYU because of that. I was like, I want to be a filmmaker. This is definitely what I want to do with my life.
Wow.
I got in. I actually got into NYU, but I couldn't afford to go there. It was like 40 grand a year to go.
Yeah.
This is 1987.
Right.
It was ridiculously expensive for its era. Even today, it's very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't go, but I got in on the strength of and what do they call those submissions? I wrote an essay about Blue Velvet and how it changed me. And so in college, sophomore year of college, that's when Wild at Heart, you know, his big follow-up came out. And shortly around that time, you know, Lynch had won, I think, like the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival, and he was very celebrated as an auteur filmmaker. This is in the days of early Spike Lee films and auteur. There was kind of an auteur era during that time period. But man, oh man, I don't know who greenlit, you know, Twin Peaks and the origin story of that. But when this came on, I was nuts about it because I was obsessed with David Lynch. And you have to appreciate the era of what TV was like in this time.
Yeah, what was the contemporary of Twin Peaks?
Okay, so let's talk about that. So the top TV shows of 1990 were The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
All right.
Beverly Hills 90210.
Right.
Seinfeld, Law and Order, Cheers, Who's the Boss, L.A. Law, Alf, Full House, Quantum Leap. It was the era of sort of saccharine sitcoms and
hard-boiled,
you know,
crime thrillers.
Yeah, law procedurals. I mean, The Cosby Show was huge in this time period.
spoiler Golden alert: World. That does not end well.
But you know, I mean, The Golden Girls, Designing Women. This is what was on the cover of Entertainment Weekly. This is what people were kind of – this was what the typical TV show was in that time period.
Right, right.
And you compare that to the likes of Blue Velvet or Wild at Heart, and it couldn't be further apart in the spectrum, right? And they released Twin Peaks on Thursday nights up against Cheers.
Right.
Cheers.
Right.
Cheers was one of the biggest shows on TV.
Sure.
I mean, that was you think Modern Family and Big Bang Theory and stuff like this is dominant? Go back to and look at the ratings for Cheers during this era. You know, you're talking 40, 50 million people watching this stuff religiously. And, you know, kind of out of nowhere, the show gets dropped and it became an instant phenomenon. I mean, the pilot had 34.6 million viewers.
Wow.
34.6. It was the highest rated show, highest rated episode of TV ABC had had in 4 years.
That's the movie. They showed that as like a TV movie, so it was over a three hours long by the time they chopped it with commercials. Or
yeah, that's about right. But I mean, those numbers don't exist anymore.
No.
You know, 34.6 million by the end of season one. You know, a lot of people had dropped out because it was a little too esoteric and surreal for, I think, the average audience member. But still, by the end of season one, they had maintained 18.7 million.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of, you know, Game of Thrones, which is
that's
you
about
know,
where
Walking
they're. Yeah.
Dead
yeah. That's that. And those are the biggest shows on television now.
Yeah. Now, and so, you know, this is 27 years ago. So, you know, things have changed so much, but, you know, just watching this, TV in this era was appointment television.
Uh-huh.
If you were lucky enough to own a VCR and knew how to program it, you could record this. And, you know, but in colleges, this show was huge.
Right.
I mean, we'd have people 15, 20 deep in watch parties, dressing up. You know, having coffee and cherry pie, and it was a real phenomena. It was crazy. It also was kind of the one of the ABC executives was coined as saying this was water cooler phenomena, and water cooler as a term wasn't really in wide use in this time.
Uh-huh.
And so the idea of talking about and solving something, you know, was kind of the precedent for so much of what we experience as TV commonality, common experience in our prestige, peak TV, you know, kind of day-to-day TV viewing, right?
Right. And so you were coming at it, you kind of, I guess, knew what to expect, or you were hoping for, like, some weirdness. Now, the first couple episodes, and maybe until the end of the third episode, I thought it was a fairly straight... A lot more straight than I thought, than I was imagined. Were you kind of like dismayed initially, and then as it got weirder, jubilant? Or what was your mindset, and I guess the mindset of the average TV person and maybe the Twin Peaks fan as this stuff got weirder? Because like my experience with Twin Peaks, you know, I was a adolescent. I was like 13, 14 years old when this thing came out. And I remember it being like there was like TV Guide would have like, you know, like when for season two coming back, they had these big pullouts where it would show like all the characters and how they're related and like all. And I remember like being attracted to the lore. And also like I remember in purient terms, People Magazine had a 50 most beautiful people where I think three of the three main women from like Laura Flynn Boyle, Cheryl Finn, and who am I forgetting? Madchen.
Sherilyn Finn.
Madchen. Kelly.
Amick.
Yeah, Amick. They were
Shelley.
All... Shelley. They were all in that thing, and I'm like, oh my god, these women are beautiful. I actually made a go out of watching, like, the first episode or two, but... in season two, and I was just immediately lost and, you know, kind of lost interest. So,
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, there were even though the first couple episodes are fairly conventional, I think from a storytelling and plot perspective, mm-hmm. there was David Lynch's fingerprints all over it. You know, these kind of weird still shots of the trees.
Right.
You know, where it's like you just see the trees waving, the very moody shots of the traffic lights.
Mm-hmm.
And the music and some of the characters, some of the actors, you know, like Jack Nance, the guy who plays Pete Martel, he has a kind of an unusual role in Blue Velvet. His fingerprints were all over it. So I knew where it was heading, even if the average viewer didn't. And I think that was actually kind of smart for Lynch and ABC that it was still quirky as hell. I mean, you know, there was nothing tonally like that. And regardless of what episode you look like, you look at on that show, even in the middle of season two, tonally, it's still so wildly different than anything that was on TV. And I was glued to it because it was different. Yeah, the soap opera-y part of Twin Peaks I never loved or identified with. I was more into the straight up murder mystery,
right,
and the all the surreal weird shit of what's inside David Lynch's head.
Why do you think he shoehorned the parody of a soap opera onto this thing? Because those when I think back at some of those moments, are so jarring. I want to talk about that, and the other thing is like the attempts at comedy in this show. I found, well, I mean, it's weird. I didn't get it, and I thought it was dumb, but then they didn't exactly grow on me, but I don't know. I at one point I stopped at least making fun of it. Like the whole Andy, Sheriff Andy, that whole character I wish fell, uh-huh, you know, had fallen into a fire and died. Like I hated the mm-hmm plot line between the pregnancy and who's that, who she's going to pick, and the, you know, the his rivalry with the clothing manager of the damn department store who was like Sal from Matt. Like did does the show know that he's gay? And Cecily were trying to debate about whether this was like one of TV's first gay characters, or whether he was just like a Liberace type and nobody. I couldn't figure out what the hell was going on with any of the attempts at comedy and the soap opera stuff. Can you talk about, does David Lynch just have a weird sense of humor? Does he not care? Was it he just doing that to? Because sometimes I think he does things just to fuck with the audience and get them into a mental state. The things that actually happen are beside the point. He's wanting to get some kind of tension or anger or anxiety in you, and he'll do it any way he can.
Well, I do think there's quite a bit. A lot of the soap opera, I think, pastiche that's in this show is really all about living in a small town. And Twin Peaks was, an absolutely perfect at defining place, mm-hmm, and a sense of place. And it's not just from the, not just through the cinematography and the locations, but the people and the things that people talk about in small towns. I mean, this is a quintessential murder mystery in a small town. And, you know, this is Clue, this is Poirot, this is all the standard, you know, types. This is a stereotype, right, in a lot of ways.
It's
but
a weird, because
Lynch is always...
As a guy who grew up in a small town that even had a sawmill as one of its standard, like, everybody works their fixtures in town, I found that some of that stuff rung true, but a lot of stuff, like, I couldn't, like, the fact that this town had a casino and like a strip joint and like all this seedy nightlife, and it's just like that. It's almost like they wanted to take the small town gossipy and charm and everybody and everybody's shit, but then mix like big city seediness to it. And I guess hand wave that it's some kind of Black Lodge mysticism around the evil woods. And I wasn't so sure how I felt about all that. I mean, it didn't, like, again, I really admire Twin Peaks enough that I plowed through, mm-hmm, God knows how many hours of television in one of my most busiest times of the year, and I'm going to plow, mm-hmm, through, what, at least 20 more with this Showtime series. Like, I was shocked when I looked and saw that it wasn't like a 10 or 12 episode normal prestige. It's like a huge episode order. But there's a couple things where, like, I liked it despite it, and I kept on thinking, like, is this David Lynch manipulating me? Is he, like, getting me angry at this character for some greater purpose? And I don't know. Andy, that never seemed like it paid. He was, like, just a comic relief, and I got no relief in his comedy, so.
Well, I do think that the mid-'80s has something to do with that, you know, what was considered to be comedy at the time. But even still, Lynch is just and I do – I always – we always say it's Lynch, but it's Lynch and Mark Frost, and I
that's true.
I'm not an expert on, you know, the lore of Twin Peaks and how did they actually divvy up their duties. I mean, it was clearly a lot of Lynch's vision, and I'm not sure what all Mark Frost brought to the table in their collaboration.
I did the thing that drives me nuts about it is that I'm deathly afraid to do any kind of Googling on Twin Peaks, because, like, all the major Twin Peaks wiki sites have kind of blended already folded in revelations from the new series to the old. And I'm like, oh, God. But I did read some, like, interviews and stuff, and it seems like that maybe Frost had a similar influence on Lynch that, like, Parada had on Damon Lindelof in The Leftovers. Mm. Like, he's always the guy that is like, all right, cool story, bro. How about if we pump the brakes just a time or two and still have the unicorn, but maybe it's not shitting rainbows and throwing up kittens. So like that he was kind of like you would filter and harness what David Lynch wanted to put on the screen. That's what my understanding is of the relationship.
I have read quite a bit about that aspect of it, but I don't know what, you know, if you look at all the things that showrunners have to do and the things that they can bring to the table. I know that he worked heavily with Lynch in the plotting of certain aspects of the story and outlining, like, the first season that, you know, this show actually had a stable of writers, right? Lynch and Frost didn't write any of it, to my knowledge. They just outlined it, kind of in the same way Lynch, I mean, Gilligan and his team do, where they do that, you know, carding exercise where they go through all the beats and it's pretty detailed. Apparently season one and parts of season two were heavily detailed by Lynch and Frost and then handed over to writers, and occasionally writers would bring a little nuance here or there to it, but it didn't go out the door without their approval and their stamp of yes, that was a good contribution. But then they both backed away, and largely Lynch backed away in season two from having any engagement on that level. And so the outlines were much looser and different writers' influence came into the story. And I, you know, I don't know how their writers' room worked, but that's, I think, why season two is all over the place, is because a lot less of it was being detailed from Lynch and Frost.
Yeah.
And it was more turned over to the freedom of the writers.
So tell me, because I thought the first season of Twin Peaks was one of the most exciting things I'd seen in a while. And keep in mind, this is my expectations. I was concurrently watching The Leftovers, which is kicking my ass and blowing my mind on a weekly basis. And it's still this show from, what, 25 years plus ago was getting my attention. I found it harder to focus on. I found season two, even like the good parts, quote unquote good parts, were kind of spotty, and there was a lot more weird stuff going on the edges that I wasn't quite sure about. And then I skipped like episode 13 through 20, and I watched 21 and 22, which I believe is the penultimate and finale. Can you give me like a thumbnail of what I missed in? Because, you know, obviously Heather Graham showed up, and she's some kind of you know, like soulmate for Agent Cooper. They clearly developed this, you know, Black Lodge. They completely introduced this Wyndham Earl, who, you know, I have no clue what the hell. I gather that he was a colleague once of Cooper's. Oh, that's the other fucking thing. David Lynch put himself in the series as that deaf, what was his name? Gordon?
Yeah.
Like, I told Seth, like, I was like, oh my God, that's David Lynch. He's like, no, it's not. And I'm like, I swear to God, like, I haven't seen many pictures of David Lynch, but I'm almost certain that that's David Lynch. Why is he there? Why is he deaf? Why did he decide to play himself? Do you know any of the Apocrypha in this, or like how that?
Like, I really don't know that.
I just found this about tonight because I started doing a little bit of like Bob was the hairdresser that accidentally was seen in a reflection of like the pilot episode, and Lynch decided he liked his look and then decided to cast him as the main malevolent force in the whole thing. Like, I can't believe that seems crazy that something like that would happen. That's like Harrison Ford banging together a set on Star Wars and then someone saying, you know what, I think he would be a good Han Solo. It's like, what the hell? How does that happen?
You know, Lynch is, he's well known to be into transcendental meditation. And he There's a scene in episode 3, I think it is, and you're much more fresh on the material of this show than I am, because the last time I rewatched, I think completely, was years ago. Most of what I've been doing is just dipping in on episodes and kind of refreshing, you know, the Fire Walk With Me movie or key episodes from the story, because it's all well indexed on the internet now. And I just looked up what episode was that again, where they explain X, Y, and Z.
Right.
And a lot of what was in towards the end of season 2 was trying to set up storylines for season 3, which they didn't know if there was going to be one or not. And then
that was my question of whether they knew that season 2 was going to be it. And so was that a cliffhanger, or, you know, like the ultimate reveal that Dale Cooper is possessed by Bob? Was that a cliffhanger, or was that like David Lynch dropping a mic and saying, you know, something about the world?
Yes. Well, how a lot of things were to resolve in season 2, we never got to see, because that's exactly what happened. Is David Lynch came back in and said, "Sorry guys, I'm doing whatever the F I want at the end of this series, and I don't care what you guys have planned for season 3, because I don't think it's going to happen." Mm-hmm. And then he kind of resolved things the way he wanted to, and there was a little graphic that was circulated in the forums that's called the Twin Peaks Survival Guide.
Right.
And it tells you which episodes to watch and all that kind of stuff. Uh-huh. And there's a bunch of things that they talk about in that graphic about why season 2 went off the rails. Uh-huh. And they say ABC, you know, forced Lynch and Frost to resolve the murder of Laura Palmer. And Lynch is quoted in millions of interviews to say, "They screwed up the show by forcing us to resolve this. My intent, me being Lynch, his intent was to never resolve it." And
really?
Yeah.
I don't know about that.
Exactly. I mean, that sounds dubious at best. And who knows how long he actually intended for the show to go on. But if you remember Who Shot JR, mm-hmm. right, and on the TV show Dallas, right, we didn't learn who shot JR until mid-season 4, mm-hmm. right? It was like the 8th or 9th episode of season 4. Mm-hmm. So if they can drag Who Shot JR out that long and have it be compelling and highly rated TV – Then you can't quote me on that. I don't know if it was compelling, but I know it was highly rated. But
yeah, I remember people that like Who Shot JR is kind of a joke at this point, like as like, you know, for maximum tease, minimum payoff.
Right. But I mean, I do think David Lynch could have easily gone several seasons and not revealed who shot Laura Palmer and have it be widely, you know, heavily compelling and interesting and yada, yada, yada. But, you know, once he was forced, and I think it was really more that he was forced to do it prematurely than as opposed to what his own timetable was in his head for resolving the mystery. Once they forced him to do that, he didn't want anything to do with the show.
Yeah.
And that was kind of his major problem. The other problem was season 1 was 8 episodes.
Right. Almost ahead of its time as far as like golden age length.
Exactly. And season 2, ABC wanted to milk the shit out of this. So they ordered 22 episodes, and Lynch did not want to do that. He wanted an 8 to 10 episode order for season 2. Mm-hmm. Same for season 3. And he could have easily, I think, resolved the who shot Laura Palmer maybe, you know, at the end of season 3. There was, I think there was quite a bit there. ABC, though, if you read any of the interviews with the executives, they say the audience was clamoring for an answer. That's why they forced Lynch.
That's true. I believe that's true. That's what they do.
I believe that's true, but they also, it was also not unheard of. And if it was done compellingly, who gives a shit, you know, but okay. But there was also some weird stuff kind of behind the scenes. Kyle MacLachlan was dating Laura Flynn Boyle.
Because obviously they were trying to set up something with Shelley and him, right? Or no, not Cher. Audrey. Yeah, Audrey, Cheryl Finn's character. And I'm like, huh, this is going to be interesting how they turn the corner on this. And then that just went away. And Cecily told me, because I guess she did. She's fearless. She doesn't have to do a podcast and have to preserve any kind of artistic or podcaster integrity. So she's just like sitting beside me on Wikipedia, like, oh my God. Oh my. And I'm like, what the hell? So one of the things she said she could tell me was that apparently the reason that went off the rails is because Laura Flynn Boyle didn't like it. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, are you kidding me?
Yeah, that's – well, I mean, there were these kinds of things behind the scenes that were also going on that I think made – and look, this happens on shows all the time.
What did she think when Roller Girl came wheeling through the studio?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, regardless, everybody knows season two was a mess. If you read any of Lynch's modern reviews, modern interviews with him, he says unequivocally season two sucked. He said the only thing he's proud of is the pilot, and everything else he's very uncomfortable with. But I think the interesting thing about Lynch is he's not interested in answers or definite resolution. This is exactly why Jim doesn't like this show.
Yeah.
And it's why he doesn't like Mulholland and a lot of the things that Lynch does, is because it's not conventional storytelling where there's clear resolution of plot and character. It's in his mind more like life and more interesting to not answer than to be clear and answer things. I mean, just watch any of his interviews from the last 15 years. You'll see the interviewer try to pin him down on something, and he's not interested in definite answers about anything.
Yeah.
It's much more interesting for him to leave things to interpretation. Mm-hmm. He's definitely got ideas about about everything in the scene, the music, the visual, the acting. He's got clear ideas about all of that. It's just very unconventional to what we're used to. But this show had insane impact on all the modern showrunners of our day. Right. You know, Lindelof, it's funny that you're watching this at the same time as The Leftovers, because Lindelof and JJ and a number of the people from Lost, they've all said there would have never been a Lost and there never would have been a Leftovers without Twin Peaks.
No, and Lindelof was saying the whole time, anytime he gave an interview, he always brought it to like, I am so giddy that my show is airing as a peer to the remake or the return of Twin Peaks. Like, that pleased him on a fan level so much. And I got and totally, like, you see this is the prequel to the X-Files. Like, Agent Cooper is Fox Mulder in a toned down version of Dale Cooper, actually, is Fox Mulder. You know, I feel like the X-Files rarely got to be as funny. Because here's the thing. Like, I did find a lot of things in Twin Peaks funny, but I don't think they were, like, funny as written. You know, just the fact that, like, you know, like the mountain, the table's full of mountains full of donuts, and Dale Cooper, Riley, just, you know, talking about, oh, it's a cop's dream. And, like, some of that stuff I thought was hilarious in a kind of a weird way. And the fact that, like, there was this time when they went to talk to Ronette, and they were – him and Sheriff Truman were struggling with this, like, stool for 5 minutes. There was this, like, a five-minute scene where they were just fucking with the furniture as a prelude to this interrogation. And I'm like, what is going on? And that was, like kind of a comedy torture, but I don't know.
Look, his sense of humor isn't for everybody. What he finds funny – and, you know, that sort of tonal space for his comedy is very unusual. And it's, in my opinion, it's one of his signatures. It doesn't mean that everybody's going to like it. I do think some of what Twin Peaks suffers from is some of the sort of the soap opera-y stuff, and the comedy doesn't always translate.
Yeah.
After 25 years. And comedy is a rough thing to translate over time.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I mean, go look at any of the great, you know, comedies of the 80s or 90s.
There's
most
a lot
of them
of,
are
lot,
not
lot
funny
of,
at all.
A lot of cringy stuff. And I've, that's been unfortunate with me. Like, I've tried to show Jack on some, you know, some... like, for example, we went to see, or not to see, I showed him the first Naked Gun.
Uh-huh.
And, like, I still think a lot of stuff is funny, but it's so of the moment, and it's so dependent on pop culture references and political references, and, like, the only thing that still works is the slapstick, which is still really, which is really still funny. But so much of that stuff just doesn't hit anymore. But I don't know, like, Twin Peaks, like, for example, like, I kept on thinking as I was watching Twin Peaks, like, how much better this would have been with, like, a baseline competent score that wasn't intentionally trying to, I guess, ape the tropey soap opera overwrought emotional displays of the time. Because I felt like, unlike, like, The Leftovers, where it's not fair to say that it does the heavy lifting because everyone's doing heavy lifting, but it certainly is carrying its fair share. I felt this soundtrack in dramatic moments was just kicking the film in the crotch.
I could see how some of the more lighthearted aspects of the score I thought were ridiculous, but then there's other parts of the score that I think are genius. I mean, Angelo Badalamenti.
You're right. There were like, when I'm talking about the stupid stuff is like anytime there's grief going on, or anytime there was like Donna. There's this theme that Donna and Bobby had. And I just wanted to stab my ears out every single time that thing started up.
Yes.
Like, it was like the 2 minutes hate from 1984 with me and Cecily every single time that thing fired up. And I'm like,
sure.
Some of the, you know, like, I talked a lot of shit in the podcast about how I just didn't find Bob terrifying.
Uh-huh.
Bob gets terrifying. Like, towards the end of season, and some of the stuff in the finale episode is as scary as I've ever seen any place. Like, I mean, not in like not like a Conjuring type, but just in a, like, you know, when Laura, like, undead Laura Palmer comes at you with her milky eyes and the strobe effect, it's really affecting.
Yeah.
That whole episode where Dale's is getting lost in the Black Lodge is really creepy and scary. And the performance that they get out of, like, Kyle MacLachlan's unhinged, maniacal look as he's smashing his head into the mirror, I mean it works, it works like a champ, man. And I just, like, it's so weird, like, it's a tale of two shows. Like, it's got this it's like peanut butter and it's like chocolate and dog shit instead of peanut butter. Like, it is not two great tastes that taste great together. And it doesn't seem like, even as you, as a Lynch fan, it's like, it, you also recognize the fact that some of this art is not doing its job, or you're at least feeling me on that.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't disagree with anybody's, you know, take or reaction to Twin Peaks. I mean, the reason why is that, look, it's not for everyone, A. B, all of it is not for everyone. I mean, I remember quite vividly my friends and I talking about certain aspects of the show, like, you know, the woman who's obsessed with the drapes.
Yes,
you know,
oh my god, her plot where she went back to be in a high schooler was like, whew.
Yeah, it's really awful stuff.
Uh-huh.
And but I will sit through hours of that to get to moments in the Red Room and the giant appearing, and you know, while Cooper's got multiple bullets in him, and
right, that was great.
You know, all of that stuff is so unique and powerful, and or just Audrey Horne dancing through the diner with this kind of, you know, dreamy music. It's like that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That's what, like, you know, if you look at the list of people who were in all of these, like, why is Twin Peaks one of the most influential shows, and why don't you have all the shows you have today is because of this? It's because people like David Chase, Chris Carter, Matthew Weiner, Vince Gilligan, Brian Fuller, Sam Esmail, Noah Hawley, all these people, Damon Lindelof, they were watching this and they were being affected by it just like I was, because it was so unique and unusual and powerful.
Yeah.
And man, it is it's a fantastic read to go out there and read interviews like with David Chase or Damon Lindelof, who go down, you know, very detailed and talk about the sense of place and how they learned about how do you do world building.
Mm-hmm.
Twin Peaks was an education for all of them.
Sure.
On things like that. And how do you bring unusual things? I mean, the role of dream sequences inside of The Sopranos, you can draw a nice clear line from this show to that, or a lot of the mythos of Lost, you can draw a clear line from A to B on some of this stuff. You remember when Legion came out, everybody was making the David Lynch parallels, mm-hmm. you know, about how Twin Peaksian and odd it was. That drove me nuts, because very few people, yes, you could say it was influenced by, but very few people can nail the David Lynch aesthetic, the tone, the mm-hmm. all of it put together, you know. And that's, I think, what really defines an auteur, right? Is somebody who can kind of, you know, whether it's Soderbergh or Spike Lee. I mean, Spike Lee's got such a clear signature. The stories he likes to tell, the visuals, the sound, the actors. You put it all together, and it's a unique voice.
Mm-hmm.
And in that respect, you have to appreciate it. But from a pure entertainment perspective, this kind of stuff isn't for everybody, dude. You know? So that's why I can't really say, you know, you didn't like it? Okay. I mean, it's not even worth arguing about. Now,
no,
I will argue about
Lost. I wish – well, I mean, yeah, I don't know which side you want to take, but one of these days I want to have like a show. I'm just going to have a podcast called Aaron Fights – the world on Lost. I'm just going to invite just like whoever fucking you hit up my Twitter, first person, call me and we will fight. It's like, you know, meet me after school on the steps, and we'll just duke it out, because god damn it, I'm so tired of you know, dealing with that shit. Well, so another thing I'm curious about, why did no one break out of this show? If it was like this big cultural influence, like, it's amazing how no one of note that I can think of made it out of this show alive. Like, Laura Flynn Boyle is arguably the biggest one, but I don't think like she had a renaissance with what was it, The Practice?
Mm-hmm.
And then that kind of like she blew it, started dating Jack Nicholson, and she was in Men in Black, what, 2 or 3, and then she had some unfortunate plastic surgeries, and she's got, like, mm-hmm. No one came at it like, and like I was just really surprised, because you had like clearly talented people who looked amazing. Like Kyle MacLachlan obviously has so much talent, and he's as handsome as the day is long. All the women in this show were beautiful and talented. What the hell happened? What was Twin Peaks like a curse?
Kyle, he did go on to have a really robust career. You know, he was on shows like Sex and the City and How I Met Your Mother and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And, you know, he had a movie career. He didn't get crazy big. You know, like you said, Laura Flynn Boyle did have some career. Sherilyn Fenn had some. But nobody blew up big, which is kind of a very odd, but like,
it's like weird. Cause at, like for, I was worried about the same thing would happen with Mad Men, but it seems like at least like, I don't think like if nothing else happens, like if like Elizabeth Moss gets hit by a bus tomorrow, she'll always have Mad Men and then Top of the Lake and then Handmaid's Tale. Right. And some other stuff like those, like she's clearly broke out of Mad Men. It's crazy though, like, you know, John Hamm, like he kind of, you know, he did a really good turn as a villain in Baby Driver, but he's another guy who seems like, you know, why the hell can't he just get everything thrown at him? I just felt like that. Yes, I'm not saying these guys didn't have. I mean, even Ray Wise kind of like seemed like he got typecast as a crazy man, villain, satanic figure after this. But no one had like a, like what I would call a breakout, like the way like Elizabeth Moss seems to be enjoying. You know, but maybe that's, I don't know. Maybe they didn't have as good agents. Maybe they didn't pick the roles right. Maybe they're not Scientologists. What
there was a lot less TV going on back then. Okay, that's one. But I think, you know, in the main cast, you know, Kyle MacLachlan did go on to have a substantial career. But in the main cast, most of the people, you know, there were some old timers like Ray Wise and Piper Laurie who were big before this and continue to have good careers after. Laura Flynn, Sherilyn Fenn, Match Dynamic, you know, they've had on and off careers. A lot of them have gotten a lot more work in recently because of peak TV. But really, the stable of people who were very successful that came out of this show were people like David Duchovny. This is one of his earliest roles.
You heard the, I don't know if you heard Lunch, but like my jaw, because I had heard that David Duchovny had made a cameo, and I was sticking around for that cameo, and it was like 5 to 10 seconds when he entered screen before I realized, holy shit, that's David Duchovny.
Uh-huh.
And I'm weirdly attracted to him.
Yeah. Above the nose, right?
Yeah, from the mid-nose up, beautiful woman. Mid-nose down, kind of busted. But decent legs. Well, what I mean, that was really ahead of its time.
Yeah, it was.
Like the way he articulated cross dressing, I felt like was, you know, I don't know when Ed Wood came out, but like I guess Ed Wood is probably the next thing that kind of pushed, like, you know, kind of didn't do it as a stunt or like, oh, what a weirdo, mm-hmm. like tried to get into the psychology of it. I don't know.
Well, I'm no authority on you know, transgender roles and presentations and
certainly,
whatnot, but Lynch trucked in a very odd world in life.
I would believe
And there was this weird bar in L.A. I lived in L.A. for a little under a year, and there was this weird bar that had these huge white booths, and it was a piano bar that a lot of very unusual people used to come in West Hollywood. And, you know, I don't want to say transgender equals unusual, but it isn't something you run into every day.
Right.
And Lynch usually had in his shows a kind of, you know, a really broad variety of life considering where he was, you know, where the show was supposed to be in the Pacific Northwest. I think he had a very diverse cast, and that was pretty unusual for its time. But this was Heather Graham's earliest roles was on this show.
Right, right.
Billy Zane, and then there's a bunch of character actors like Chris Mulkey, who just played Billy Gatwood on Better Call Saul. You know, he had a big role in Twin Peaks. Miguel Ferrer, who just died, but he's been on every show, you know, under the sun. You know, the guy who played Albert, right? Coroner kind of guy who does the autopsies and whatnot. Uh-huh. There was a lot of these character actor folks who came through the show that I think did have rich careers. You know who really had rich careers? Were the directors on this show. There was, I don't know if you recall Leslie Linka-Glater. You know, she's really well known as one of the top directors in TV. She was doing Homeland, The Newsroom, The Walking Dead, mm-hmm. Justified. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's directed an episode of everything, Mad Men.
Right.
You know, a lot of the directors on this show's Tim Hunter, who works now on Bosch and Hannibal. James Foley is on Billions and House of Cards. There was a good stable of kind of below the line talent, not the acting talent, that had very storied careers, and this was very early in their career. So
that makes sense. That makes sense.
I think it does, but you know, this cast was massive.
It really
was. And
maybe
that's why there wasn't.
It was too ensemble. It's kind of it's the friend factor, you know, like there's just. No one could break out because everyone's roughly the same velocity. And
yeah,
you know.
Exactly. And maybe that was it. You know, other than, you know, Agent Cooper, you know, who kind of threaded everything together, just about everybody had small ensemble roles.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Maybe that was it, or maybe it was people became typecast, you know, for doing weird stuff on Twin Peaks. I don't know.
Just, yeah, that's the thing. It's like, seems like that's the one thing advantages, because like it almost defies typecasting. Like, how do you, like, it's the roles are so crazy, and I guess they're memorable, but like, it's like, you know, I read something interesting where, I guess I haven't seen Fire Walk With Me. That's my next immediate goal, is to watch Fire Walk With Me. Is that Kyle MacLachlan's role was scaled down because he was afraid of being typecast as, you know, Agent Cooper. But yeah, I found that hard to believe. It was, you know, it's like typecast implies that there is a type to be cast to. And these guys were these were just so unique. Like, they rolled off the assembly line, and then they destroyed the plant, burn it down like the fucking woodmill. That's crazy. But, you know,
I think Fire Walk With Me is a brilliant piece of work. It's kind of unusual because it's a prequel, but the way it kind of fills in story that wasn't part of Twin Peaks, you know, the show. It's insanely beautiful, and it's got these unbelievable guest roles, like David Bowie is in Fire Walk With Me.
No kidding.
And yeah, he's incredible. Chris Isaac plays an FBI agent.
Oh, nice.
Do you think I'll
like it?
I loved it. It's more traditional Lynch than it is, like, just about all of the soap opera is entirely removed. It's all in the straight up Lynch vein. And I think he used it to explore things that he didn't get a chance to do on the show. And he had, you know, he had a lot more control, and he kind of co-wrote it, and, you know, did he did everything like he likes to. And to me, it's the quintessential Twin Peaks story. I thought it was beautiful. It fills in a whole ton of events that could have easily been part of the show, but for some reason or another, they never got to explore. And when I saw it, it made me wonder if they had not asked Lynch and crew to resolve who killed Laura, what we would have gotten through a remainder of two or three seasons with Lynch full press involved, because it's genius. It does some absolutely beautiful stuff.
That was the other question I had. How the hell did David Lynch get to make a Twin Peaks movie? Did he, like, is there something in his contract that he owned all the rights to his characters? Did he cut a check to ABC? How did that work?
That's a good question. I don't know much about the rights and, you know, how they were able to,
because it came
do
out,
because
that's
like
the thing is, like, my recollection, because, you know, like, my connection to pop culture is pretty hazy and tenuous until my mid-20s, as a lot of people know, or late 20s. But my cultural memory was that the death came out like 10 years after Twin Peaks, but it didn't. It came out a year or two after Twin Peaks ended.
Yeah, so let's New Line, I don't know if you remember New Line Cinema. They were kind of like an art house distributor. And, you know, I suspect that he maintained some rights. But he was still very, even though the show had ended, he was still very caught up in the world, and he wanted to kind of get it out of him and get it on film. You know, this movie, Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, had a budget of $10 million, and it only made 4.2 in the box office.
Wow. I was surprised at how bad it bombed, just because I thought there'd be more looky-loos, you know, since Twin Peaks is so big. How does it how do people not, you know, I guess that's the other question I had, is like, what did you think of the finale? Like, did you know that was it for Twin Peaks? Did you suspect that was it for Twin Peaks? Did you find it satisfying?
I did. I found it tremendously satisfying. And you know, I was...
That was a hell of an hour of television, I got to say.
It was incredible.
It had me on the edge of my seat. Like literally, I was pumped throughout the whole episode. And just like, what the hell? What the hell? What the hell is going to happen? But I just wondered how, because I also knew that, like, the story is going to continue, particularly with Kyle MacLachlan, and they've got this, and, you know, Lynch's tactic. So I wasn't as kind of like, oh my God. I just wondered, like, so you found it actually satisfying knowing
I did.
Like being ambiguous about whether you'd get more or whether the story would continue.
Well, it was well known at that Lynch had checked out, you know, even during the run of the show.
But the finale was his baby, so.
Exactly. And there was promotion that he had kind of come back, and it was clear, you know, that his hand, you know, was he was behind the camera and he was driving it. And it was everything that I wanted the show to be was that stuff. I didn't care for, you know, mm-hmm. all the just absolutely ludicrous sort of schmaltzy, you know, storylines. And
right.
and it was a return to form, and it gave, you know, I had a lot of faith in that there was this guy was still invested and that he could somehow wrestle the control. I mean, he is a bit of a control freak, and he likes to, you know, I don't want to say control freak. He has a vision and he wants to actualize it. I mean, you saw him even dunk out. He backed away from the return because he didn't feel like he was getting enough money. And so he just stepped away from it and said, okay, I won't make the sequel. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And they ended up ponying up the money for him to do the show exactly the way he wanted to. But man, oh, man, the finale, you know, you spend like 30 plus minutes in the Red Room.
Yeah.
You know, that sequence, you're just it really is kind of hard to describe to people. But
yeah, it really is. Like I was just for a joke. I said, I actually, and I might do this. I said, Jim, I want us to live watch the finale with you knowing no more than the first two or three episodes of Twin Peaks and see what the hell you can make of it. Because you know how it started. You know how it kind of starts right. as a fairly conventional murder mystery. And then showing that final hour, I think it would be insanely popular and it would be a hoot. But I would just love to see what the – like, he might just be like, well, fuck, it's fucking Lynch's thing I've ever seen. Like, I dodged a bullet. But I don't know, because there's some – especially since he's got such a big horror background, there's a couple of things that just so viscerally work so well that I'm amazed. Like, it's like you can't deny that it's artfully done.
Well, the Red Room is iconic.
Yes.
Right? Yeah, and
– like, literally –
yeah, and when you look at it, I you know, of course the Red Room is in the sequel, right, that he's done now. Mm. And there's a couple episodes that feature the Red Room quite a bit. And it didn't hit me until I was watching this one episode of the sequel, how simple of a set it is.
Yes.
It's just curtains and a floor and a couple pieces of furniture.
The chevron floor and the, you know, Venus,
the
Milo or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. It's incredibly simple, but it's very powerful in the way they did that reverse recording. I mean,
yeah.
I remember everybody talking about how they did – and it was cheap effects,
uh-huh.
you know? I mean, all I did was have the actors say shit backwards and then play it forwards,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, there's not a lot of technology in it, but it is the biggest mindfuck you've ever seen.
Yeah, because when I first saw it, I'm like, I was wondering if, like, they were – because they were – because I was like, well, they're talking backwards. But I'm like, well, no, it sounds forwards – so maybe yeah. they're like – what they're doing is they're speaking as they inhale, because, you know, you can kind of do that sometimes and it gives you a weird – but the movements – and then I realized what they had done is, yes, they had played – the actors had performed backwards and they're playing it forwards now. I still don't know
right.
why in the first time that – why is Cooper in old makeup in the first appearance of the Red Room?
I don't have an answer for
okay.
you.
Okay. I wonder, because yeah. like I was like, maybe they answered that in the 12 episodes I skipped. But I was like,
no.
That's still like one of the things when, you know, I don't know. And I don't like – also, like, is everyone in the Black Lodge evil because the giant showed up there and I felt like he was wholly benevolent? I don't – yeah, I just got a lot of questions about it. Maybe they'll answer in a new series. I don't know. Do you know if the new series is like – is this a finale? Is this like – a one shot and then done?
Yes.
Or okay.
Yes.
So
it's a one and done 18 episodes.
So you
That's
can expect
it.
Whatever finality you can expect from a David Lynch piece. whatever resolution or answer, which is probably none now that I'm thinking about it.
Well, it's been interesting because I think the sequel has resolved some things.
Are you current with the sequel?
Oh, hell yes.
What's your opinion of it? Is it like, are you just over the moon about it? Because I've heard a lot of different reactions.
I'm over the moon about it because it's just having Twin Peaks, but having David Lynch, period, back in, I mean, it's been over a decade since he's released a movie.
Yeah.
And so just having him back into the discussion and creating again, I care about that more than the actual artifact. But there are I think we're on episode 10 right now, 9 or 10. And there are two of those episodes I think are some of the most impressive things I've seen on TV in over a decade.
Wow.
And other parts of it I think are entirely boring. And I just could care less. And it's like some of the stuff that was in the original series. And one of the things I hate more than anything in peak TV isms out there is we aren't making episodic TV. We're making a 20-hour movie, you know, or whatever that diatribe that we've heard over and over.
Right.
And it scared me because when Lynch was doing his early press for this show,
he drunk that Kool-Aid.
No, he was saying this is an 18-hour movie, legit. And he goes, you'll have to watch it all for it to make sense. And I believe that's true based on what I've seen, because some things he's resolved and other things, I don't know what the fuck's going on. And then other things are in that weird David Lynch, you know, odd comedy, odd exchanges and interactions that sometimes I think for some people may be hilarious, and for other people you're just sort of like, what is going on? Why am I watching this? And it does, the way he ends the episodes in the series is he just cuts to the bar in Twin Peaks and there's a band that starts playing a song, and then that's the end of the episode. It's like there's a little musical interlude at the end of every episode that acts as the transitory event between episodes. But so much of it has very little linear connectivity. There's a lot of things that seem to be happening kind of out of sequence or maybe not in true linear storytelling fashion. I mean, Jim would absolutely hate this return, no matter how much if he ever found any value in any of David Lynch's work. It's very inaccessible. But I still think there are several episodes that are stone cold brilliant. And Kyle MacLachlan is doing the best work of his career.
Wow.
In this. Yeah, I mean, it blows away. I will be shocked if he isn't A, nominated, and B, comes very close to winning. It's unbelievable some of what he's doing. But
is Twin Peaks not eligible for an Emmy this year? Because like, wasn't like half of their season?
Not,
oh, wasn't?
Okay. I don't think it is. No.
Okay.
I mean, it might have had one, maybe two episodes.
Okay.
Or something.
Yeah. Okay.
But there's a I think it's episode 8, which everybody and their brother has been talking about that saw it. And that will, I think, clean up. But, you know, I mean, I don't know if you've looked at the ratings right now for
probably
the show.
Probably not great.
0.5 million viewers.
Well, I mean, number one is on Showtime, is where shows go to die. Two... Like, I don't know. Like, it's weird. I don't know. It seems like that people don't come back for remakes as much because, like, last year when the X-Files remake came back, like, there was, like, this buzz. But when you actually look at how many people showed up to watch, it was a total turd. Now, that show was actually total. Like, I thought the X-Files renewal was god-awful.
Yeah, it was.
With some small parts of episodes an exception, but sure got awful. But I guess it doesn't surprise me because it feels like a lot of that stuff, like You know, on the other hand, like if you're saying 40 some million people tried that at some point, engaged with it in a serious, earnest way, how the hell can only 500,000 people care enough about it to check it out again? Like that seems crazy. But again, how many people have Showtime?
Well, I think Showtime's one barrier. I do think there's quite a few people who are just going to wait for it all to be aired. And
right.
then they're going to pay then Showtime $10 for 1 month.
Right. And watch it all.
And binge it. Yeah. It's long. It's definitely a long tail piece of content.
Yeah.
You know, it's one interesting thing that I'd like to share about this show is it aired once in its entirety on ABC. Right. Mm-hmm. And then in the very early days, this was a couple of years after I graduated college. So I'm thinking like 1993, mm-hmm. 94. Bravo was a fledgling network. And it was kind of what Sundance TV is today, mm-hmm. or IFC.
Right,
it's
right,
kind
right.
of like, it was kind of meant to be kind of like artsy,
right.
you know, art house cinema on TV kind mm-hmm. of spot. Mm-hmm. And they bought the rights to re-air it, and mm-hmm. it used to run a lot on Bravo, which is now, you know, housewife reality TV.
Right.
It's kind of odd in its own right, but a lot of people actually watched the show through Bravo for its first time because there were some weird rights about it being released on VHS and later on DVDs, and it didn't come out on DVDs till somewhere around 15 years after it was made, maybe even more than that, like 20 years. It hasn't been on DVD that long. And so there was it has a weird place in TV history because, like, you couldn't go pick up Twin Peaks at your local Blockbuster.
Right.
So there was like a decade where nobody, if you didn't watch it the first time it aired or on one of the Bravo reruns, and most people didn't have Bravo as part of their cable package. You know, it didn't. Most people didn't have the opportunity to go see this iconic piece of TV until almost 15 years after it aired, when
right.
it came out on DVDs. And I think that has a lot to do with its heritage. And, you know, it wasn't like it was on Netflix for the last 10 years.
Yeah, when did Netflix get it? Because I guess that's the other thing I'm surprised is there's so much little interest, because it's there for Netflix. I mean, everyone's got Netflix, and it's there for the binging.
Yeah, and I think it's actually on Hulu as well. And
maybe that's
the
part where they get to midway through season two and like, what the hell? And like, I would love to know. I would love to see the watch stats for that. Like, you know, like I hear sure. so much about Twin Peaks. Like, oh my God, this is amazing. Okay, I don't get this. Okay, I'm out.
Well, in season one, it went from 35 million to 19 million. So it almost got cut in half in season one. And in season two, it went from 19 million to 10 million.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 million back in the day was considered a failure.
Right.
It was like, why are we even doing this? I mean,
right.
today, 10 million is top 15, top 10 TV, you know? But it dropped ratings in half in the second season. And so, you know, I can't speak to its heritage, but when you saw everybody, when it was fully announced that this was coming back, it's going to be the same way when they bring Deadwood back. I mean, it's iconic, influential, and influential to the creators of modern TV.
Yeah,
I mean,
totally.
Brian Fuller and Sam Esmail and Damon Lindelof, they've given some fascinating interviews about how this show affected them and impacted how they tell stories. And in that respect, I think it's worth people investing the time to kind of see how it influenced what we have today.
No, I think especially if you don't get wrapped up in the mystery, like the first season is sublime. Like it definitely has things I don't think work, but I debate about whether in Lynch's mind it works because he was trying to get, you know, you to feel a certain, you know, like that. Like I said, I already had that debate, but like, I think the first 8 episodes were just astounding. And I just could, like, it is something that you could put on the shelf next to the golden age of television, right? Like,
yes,
like I didn't feel like I've gone back and watched like season one of Oz and like, okay, I understand for its day. You know, and like season one of Sopranos, and like, you know, it's like which I don't know. I need to see the whole thing one of these days, and I don't want to piss any, but God knows I don't want to piss anybody else off. But I don't know how well that even is holding up after, you know, things have matured so much. But, like, Twin Peaks really was, you know, 20 years ahead of its time. And the fact that this was on broadcast television, like, it was so extreme. Like, it's like it was an effect like if I had – you know, if I had gone back and read that, like, Walmart in the late 80s was selling water that was laced with LSD, you know, like their Sam's Choice water had LSD, and that was a thing for like 2 years. Like, that's like, I just couldn't believe that that was on mainstream network television and that people loved it. Like, that was the other thing. Yeah. You know, like you pitch this down mainstream America and they knock it out of the park. That's so interesting. Like that almost never happens.
Yeah, absolutely. It's remarkable it was made, and it was remarkable that it was successful as it was, considering how unusual it was. I mean, that very little of, like, once you kind of follow after Twin Peaks and you look at David Lynch's work that kind of comes after it, you're talking about Lost Highway, Mulholland Drive. You know, those he gets progressively less accessible.
Yeah.
I think in terms of his, you know, in terms of traditional storytelling, and becomes more esoteric and more unusual.
That's
and
fair.
Certainly. What's interesting about the return, the sequel of Twin Peaks, is in so many ways, not only is it a sequel to the TV show, it's a sequel to all the ideas littered throughout his entire body of work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are clear allusions and references to Blue Velvet, Wild at Heart, Lost Highway, Mulholland Drive. All, I feel like it's a sequel to everything he's ever made.
Yeah.
And in that respect, I'm glued every week, and sometimes I get the weird soap opery story with over tinges of weird cultural commentary and references.
Right.
And then you get buckets in between all of that that are just unlike anything that you've ever seen. And some people look at it like you look at it, like the way dogs look at you when you're talking. They just kind of cock their head and go, nope, that's not for me. And for the rest of us, it is everything. And man, I cannot wait to see where the back half of this new revival goes, because I know it's going to end up somewhere stunning. And who knows what the hell he's got in store for us the last few episodes of this story.
Right. Well, I'm excited to catch up, and the reason I'm kind of doing this podcast is to kind of, I'm hoping to, if I can catch up here in the next week or two, start doing some kind of like bi-weekly thing with you and a couple other podcasters I have in mind and I've talked to privately, to kind of, you know, talk through, because especially, you know, I've heard lots of different things. Like, I've heard, you know, I don't want to name names until they can, you know, defend their arguments. But I've heard all over the place from people I respect. Like, I mean, Chris and Andy on the Watch, which, you know, Andy and I, we've had a one sided rivalry, a feud, where it's like, it just seems like everything I love, he shits on. But I do, like, as I've listened to his podcast, I kind of respect his opinion more. And like, him and Chris are just like talking in Twin Peaks as if it's hushed tones, and Damon Lindelof talks about how great it is, and then you're telling me all this stuff. But then I've also heard other people who are just kind of like, yeah, you know, it is what it is, and it's David Lynch and all that. So I'm really curious to see for myself. So I hope you come back on when I get caught up, and we can talk about it when I've got all of this under my belt. Now, the other big question: do you think it's worth my time? Knowing me the way you do, which, you know, certain familiarity of hearing me talk for as much as you and hearing my opinions. Do you think it's worth for me to go back and pick up the 10 or 12 episodes that I skipped? Do you think, or do you think that's better left by the wayside?
No, I think there's a lot of interesting story you know, more so in the sort of later part of the season two. I mean, I certainly don't see any problem skipping, you know, 13, 14, 15, you know, that kind of mid spot. But 17 and on, it really starts to pick up. Like, whoever made this survival guide graphic on Reddit, it's so absolutely perfect in every way. I couldn't agree more with the
because I like how the red is not say bad. It's mad sketchy, which I think as a person I watched for the red episodes and I kind of agree that's how they should be referred to. They're mad sketchy, like what you get out of that might be what you bring into it. And your attitude and your mean and your disposition towards life.
Well, the thing you cannot miss is Firewalk With Me. I think that's quintessential because there are several things in the revival that are referred to story-wise that happen only in Firewalk With Me. Mm-hmm. So that is a must-see. And I think it's always worth spending your time with David Lynch work. Now, a lot of people would argue this midsection has nothing to do with him. It's funny. Diane Keaton actually directed one of these episodes.
I saw that. Yeah. I'm like, what the hell?
Yeah, it's unusual. I mean, she ended up becoming a very accomplished director, but I think this was one of her early attempts at directing. Uh-huh. But there's still a display of considerable talent. I just don't think the story is particularly entertaining, but the Wyndham Earl stuff is crazy, and there's some alien shit, and I don't know if this is like a Fishnado kind of thing for you, but there's some alien stuff that kind of happens in 13 through 21 that and some characters that fill in some of the Black Lodge understanding. What is it? Some people have theories about it. Mm-hmm. And having a better appreciation for the Black Lodge going into the revival is important. So I do think it's worth your time. Whether you'll fully appreciate it and be quote-unquote entertained, I think that's, you know, your mileage may vary in a huge way, but story-wise, there's some important stuff that won't make sense in the revival unless you've seen that.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, guess I got to take my medicine then. I gotta get mad sketchy.
Well, I do think you should jump right on the movie next.
Yeah, that's what I'm gonna do, and then get into the new stuff. And I don't know, because I just don't. There's no effing way I'm gonna have room for 12 more hours of television on top of everything else I'm doing right now. And Rick and Morty's coming down the pike, and there's a whole bunch of other stuff I want. Because like Game of Thrones is consuming my life, and rightfully so. It's like our bread and butter. But I got a lot of other irons in the fire, and I'm just trying to be as efficient as possible, efficient and entertaining as possible. Because that's what's entertaining, efficiency.
Yeah, well, of course. I do think, you know, it's interesting. I know quite a few people who never watched the original at all and are just watching the sequel and loving it.
Yeah.
You know,
I could see that. Because honestly, yeah. One of the notes I saw on Reddit when I was looking at this, like, you know, people saying, like, what am I going to miss if I'm – and they're like, you know, honestly, if you jump in for the last two episodes – there's going to be a lot of like, wait, what the fuck? But honestly, that's not a bad way to watch it.
Yeah.
You know, you just go in and there'll be characters you don't know. There'll be situations you don't know, but that's actually kind of part of the charm. So I could see just like jumping in and having it all be what the fuck would not be a bad way to do it.
Sure. Well, look, dude, you're a full-time TV podcaster. Okay. This to me is you have to understand the canon and have an appreciation for the canon. I'm somebody who will say, look, you got to do all of Deadwood. You have to understand The Sopranos and its place and what it and its impact to understand what's come after it. Right. And, you know, it's the kind of thing like when you're in school, they say, you know, if you don't understand these fundamentals, you can't appreciate the art on a higher level. And some of what all the modern creators are doing are referencing this kind of foundational work and playing off on it and riffing and extending those ideas of the form and how storytelling, you know, on TV, you know, has evolved, I think is important. No, look, I definitely think there are shit episodes of a lot of canon shows that you could absolutely skip. But so much of this is what you find pleasurable and like so much of the X-Files is garbage.
Sure.
In my opinion, you know, and I've heard you riff on this a number of times. But I also know that there are a lot of people out there who love every single bit of it. And so, you know,
That's the thing. Like, I guess like if I was saying like as a, I'm glad I watched a lot of X-Files as you know, because because you're right. The more you understand the building blocks and the techniques and how all this fits in together, and you know, I start off in like a giant hole as far as that regards. The better you are at, you know, analyzing and being critical in the best way and enjoying this stuff. But I also think that like, and I don't know, that's one little project I've had in my back pocket, like some kind of like boot camp or some kind of like cliff notes for television where, you know, like here is essentially like why this is relevant and why this is important to the culture, and here is 10 episodes you need to watch to get a feel for that. You're not going to get the full appreciation, but you're going to get some showcase. And like, what would that be for Breaking Bad? You know, like it would be you know, like the pilot and episodes like The Fly, and you know, it's like like the independent thing. You don't have to see all 72 hours or whatever of that television show, but you can watch this to get like why people highly regard it. Because I feel like that would be valuable for, because that's the thing. Like, I feel, you know, there's people being born right now that 20 years from now they're going to say, why the hell is Breaking Bad a big deal? And do you tell them to just watch it? And do you tell them to just do that for everything that people think is critical? You know, it's like it gets to be like the, you know, like how far do you want to get in literature? You know, and in England, and then we're talking English literature. We talking for it's a never ending. You can it's a fire hose that you can drink of all day, and also it goes forever back in time, and it gets more and more every freaking year. It's like at some point you got to be like, Jesus Christ, where can I go to get like, you know, just an appreciation without the whole thing? And I don't know how to do that. That's a hard problem to solve.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Alan and Alan Sepinwall and Matt Zoller-Seitz, you know, their book that came out about a year ago called TV the Book was their attempt to define the canon for TV, right? And they ended up having like 8 or 9 different metrics they judged all shows on.
How did I miss this book came out?
It came out like about a year ago.
But did Alan Sepinwall do zero press on it?
No, he pimped the hell out of it.
He probably is during Bill Simmons' suspension.
He did an AMA. I don't know that he did a Bill Simmons interview, but
he wasn't. He didn't have his podcast at the time, right? If it's about a year ago, he was in like in between Feinberg and Bill Simmons was probably fired from ESPN. And those are the ways I keep track of Alan Sepp. But I also don't think he had like an article on Uproxx about it. But he had an AMA on Reddit, and I fucking missed it. Jesus,
Yeah,
I want to get this book because I like both those guys, both those gentlemen.
Yeah, it's a fantastic book. It's they define it as the top 100 TV shows of all time, right? Mm. And so it's everything from like Andy Griffith and Mary Tyler Moore through.
How many pages do each shows get? Are there or like some get more? Or the you know is there like at least a page on everything or?
Yeah, there's at least a page on everything. It's a very extensive book, but it's super interesting because the way they do the ratings is it's kind of difficult to explain. But each of these 8 or 9 factors in which they review and talk about shows, when you look at it from the ratings only, you kind of see why these shows are important just from the ratings part of it. And But that's also how they actually calculated the rankings of shows, right? And so I think ended up being like this. The Simpsons, I think, was number one. I'd be hard-pressed to actually tell you what was in the top 10, but...
Someone I thought out of nowhere asked me, because he's like, there's some, the Alan Sepinwall recently ranked all the shows in the 20th century, you know, the last century of television, and Simpsons were number one. And my reaction was like, what the fuck? Yeah, but I guess that makes sense if you're talking about like a and I think I even said that on that lunch, like, okay, well, I guess if you're talking about the breadth and the impact and
how it remains relevant. It's really cool because they do even talk about specific episodes and why these were foundational shows for their time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're talking about guys who've been writing about TV for decades and they're fantastic critics.
Right.
So having them define a canon of shows that we can, you know, have to understand and consume a little bit to appreciate how the form developed, I think is absolutely critical. So, but there's absolutely no way to watch everything. I certainly try.
Yeah.
And,
I think you do a better job than I, but yeah, it's so hard.
It is. It is. I mean, but, you know, if you can dip into a little bit of Hannibal and American Gods and Mr. Robot and kind of understand what they're attempting and what makes them unique, I really think you appreciate the stuff that you guys do deep dives on.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
No, and like I said, I could do it. I wish I had another hour to talk about American Gods because Cecily and I still haven't gotten our final thoughts on that. And I thought that was – did you like American Gods? I thought you were kind of meh on it. Or did you not even finish it?
No, I finished it. I absolutely adored the show.
Okay.
I agree with the majority of the opinions out there about, you know, the actual plotting was a little all over the place. And but there were a couple of episodes, the finale of season one being unbelievable.
Oh, yeah.
You know, have you seen that finale?
Oh, yeah. I'm all up on.
I like what Brian Fuller did with Hannibal. I adored that show. And if you liked Hannibal, you love American Gods. But, man, that was an unbelievable first season, and I hope they continue to invest in it. Is that for everybody? Hell no. But, man, Fuller's style, he brought a lot of his Hannibal directors onto this show, and they're just doing things visually. I'm a designer
right.
by trade.
Yeah,
they're doing things visually that nobody else is doing on TV.
Yeah, I wish I could get Jim to watch the first, like, commit to watch the first four episodes, because I feel like it's similar to, because there's a lot of like, just what the hell is going on and why is everything so vague in the beginning? But there's just so much great payoff. And I don't know whether I'm in that weird period of being a critic where, like, I value novel experiences more than just objective quality, but, like, I feel like this has both. Like, it's like nothing I've seen on television. It pushes the boundaries of what's on television in ways that I think are laudable and necessary. And also, as you say, the visuals are just – and the performances. My God, Ian McShane is just it's hard not to grin ear from ear every frame that he's on the camera because he's just amazing.
Yeah, I it's funny that you mentioned that you're coming to that period where you value the experience differently than the average viewer, because I do think critics, you know, at some point in their career, they do value uniqueness over the straight up entertainment value for the average person.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's like The Leftovers. Look, there's a lot of people in our forums that I respect highly,
sure. Yeah.
You know, on the Bald Move forums that absolutely hate The Leftovers.
And I understand. And yeah.
I do. I get it. But man, the people who've watched it and stayed with it all the way and appreciate it for being one of the best shows of the last decade or two decades, you wonder why they don't – it's no surprise that they didn't get voted for Emmys. It's frustrating, but it's no surprise. Most people didn't watch it. You have to watch something, I think, to be able to accurately vote.
Yeah.
I mean, what?
It's
what,
not surprising because the Emmys is a fraudulent award show, like more so than I think a lot of them, because it's you know, and that this is about, you know, you could say the same thing about the Oscars and the Grammys and all that stuff, that they it is essentially a tool to move the sales needle. But like, I feel like the Emmys is always been because there's just so many crimes they've committed. And then I could go on and on about my I just feel like the Emmys is the worst award show from a kind of like a critical opinion kind of angle.
Well, I asked Alan Sepinwall last week on Twitter. I said, because I don't know why it never processed the fact that he's not an Emmy voter.
Right.
And because I think he wrote an article that was like,
if I had an Emmy vote. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. And I said, why don't you have an Emmy vote?
Because
this is for industry people to vote on who they think did the best work.
Yeah.
And there's a lot more people inside the industry that work on traditional shows, right? Traditional narratives. And even within the industry, you know, I follow a bunch of the Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad people, and I'm like, what do you guys think of X? And they're like, I haven't had any time to even watch it.
I think we might have talked about it. That fact that like my podcast consumption has dropped in lockstep with my podcast production. That when you're busy creating things, the time that you have to consume like material drops. And I think that's a huge, huge problem when you've got these professionals voting this stuff. And that's why you see shit like fucking House of Cards, because it's like, you know, literally like, oh, what did I put down last year? House, is that still on? Sure. Boom. Done deal. You know?
Absolutely. And that's why I won't be surprised if Twin Peaks doesn't, you know, ultimately get any kind of nominations. They'll probably, you know, clean up at like the Critics Awards and, you know, those kinds of things, you know, maybe the Golden Globes.
I just felt like that there should be like every once in a while something comes across like The Wire or The Leftovers or like Twin Peaks where like, you know, it's just it almost has to like it has to get kind of noticed. And I get it that there's no financial incentive to promote a dead show. But, like, what a fucking kick in the teeth for the actors and the people. I mean, I guess I've heard that they kind of expected it, you know, because they understand the business and they're professionals. But, man, I just think about everybody from the below-the-line types to the actors and the producers. Like, it just must be frustrating to do the best work of your life and have no one take notice of it. None of your peers.
I had never looked this up, but while you were talking, I looked up the first season of Twin Peaks had 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 13 Emmy nominations and one for Outstanding Editing and Outstanding Costume Design. But it was nominated for Best Lead Actor, Lead Actress, Supporting Actress, Best Writing. I mean, it was crazy. And then season two, it got 1, 2, 3, 4 nominations. But so there is a history of even Twin Peaks being nominated. But that was in an era when there was only a handful of TV, there was only a handful of things that could be nominated. With only four networks, it's nothing like it is today.
Right.
You know, I'm just thrilled, and man, Peak TV just keeps delivering gifts, and having Twin Peaks back is such a gift. I could care less what David Lynch does with it. I know I'm going to be, you know, blown away by some percentage of it, and then another percentage of it I'm going to go, that wasn't really my cup of tea, so...
Well, I think that's a good place to end the conversation. I kind of lost track of time. We've been talking for like almost 2 hours. We'll see what makes the final cut of the podcast. But I really appreciate you coming in and providing context for like its spot in the pantheon. And I look forward to more discussions with you about Twin Peaks in the future. And honestly, anytime there's something big that, you know, I'm watching and we're watching at the same time and it's not getting Bald Move love, like this is what Bald Move TV is for now. okay. the outlet for things I can't do a full show on. So don't hesitate to hit me up if you got a hot take on something, because we'll get you on.
Sounds great, man. Thanks for having me, and I'll talk to everybody in the forums. I'm there every day almost. So
yeah, forums.baldmove.com, Heisenberg Chronicles on .tumblr.com, right?
It's actually HeisenbergChronicles.com. I own that URL.
Nice, so. Nice. And Film Schlubs, check out that, because you had
Film Schlubs podcast.
Podcast, yep. and future Bald Move TV appearances. You can find Shane Bowman. Thank you again. Thanks for all your support and all the wisdom that you've passed on over the years. We'll talk to you again real soon.
Okay, thanks, Aaron.